The Journals of Dr. Casey. Anaxagoras, Chapter 4. 21 December 1967. In all events, the sane hallucination vexes me. How does the ordinary undiseased brain effectively broadcast its own veritable stimulus or the semblance thereof? How does it see, smell, taste, feel, indeed sometimes assume the totality of the appearance of space and time, that the percipient believes the experience actually identical to reality? How are they so readily and utterly deceived? The insane, who is presumptively afflicted with some one or more diseases that presumably include errant biochemistry or distressed organic tissue, may be deceived naturally, receiving signals from deceptive stimulus, but the sane, the ordinary percipient, under ordinary circumstance, should not have such experiences. It follows, therefore, that either some stress induces similar errant biochemistry or malfunctions of the brain, or such hallucinations as these occur from time to time, as it were randomly, or induced by mechanism and for such purpose as we have yet to ascertain. This much I may say for apparitions and for lucid dreaming, perhaps. But ESP is another case, because here I have an unstressed perception. Indeed, a deliberately conscious perception, which is not physically possible insofar as we can understand without the postulate of exomatic perception. I cannot categorize ESP as hallucination. Similarly, the NDE, while obviously induced by stress, and possessing the earmarks of extreme medical circumstance, has in many cases revealed the paradox that here is mental awareness without a body. Coupled to this, the reports of out-of-body experiences, the same phenomenon perhaps of exomatic perception, but dramatically different, we are again presented with a physically impossible perception, a physically impossible awareness, but one which, like ESP, can be corroborated by those with normal perceptions. In fact, it is the boggling aspect of ESP that the receiving percipient sees or knows the image being physically seen by the sender, giving us no objective basis upon which to deny the fact of the exomatic perception. Now, it happens that ESP is not wholly reliable. There is considerable error reported in the alleged perception. There is enough that is true to make it statistically improbable to be coincidental. But it must be said that even the most cogent ESP percipient is much of the time wrong in her or his perceptions, whereas the one with real eyes on the thing is rarely wrong. But in the case of the NDE, insofar as I can tell, the percipient is extremely acute and perception apparently reliable. When I have been able to get sufficient detail and testimony and to corroborate it, the accounts are detailed, completely accurate, impossibly true. They see the clock on the walls and the time. They see the tops of the balding surgeon's head. They see the efforts made upon their apparently dead bodies. They see the grieving relatives weeping and embracing. In short, they see things that they did not see and could not see, but see them truly. Does it follow then that all else they report is true? That is something I suppose I cannot know until I die. But it is more data than I have reliably from any other source concerning such things. That it may be, however, a sort of afterglow of life, affecting the yet uncertainly and completely dead brain, must be considered. This much may still be hallucination. Although, as my friend and colleague Professor Hawthorne has generously affirmed for me, with his catalog of certain mystical experiences, sampled from the canon of the 17th century, the celestial light which is seen and the feelings evinced are also found in non-hallucinatory states. But the exomatic experience, this lifting of one's consciousness out of the body, hovering, fully rational, fully aware, this I cannot categorize as hallucination, if only because the percipient makes reliable reports on realities he or she cannot have otherwise experienced. This then poses for me a puzzling problem. That consciousness transcends the body, that what is called mind is indeed separable from the material confines of the body in which it is ordinarily housed, that its being is to an extent independent of the body, that while ordinarily like a rider on a horse, it is carried by the body, but it may dismount it and walk about, and that while ordinarily all its sensations and knowledge come to it by way of the body, like a system of plumbing to the outside world, and we had supposed only by that plumbing did any resources come to it, all sensations, all knowledge, except what is intrinsic to it. But in fact, the mind seems to possess capacity to be separate from the body, and to receive other resources than the world pipes to it by the body's senses, and is therefore, in essence, a thing unlimited to the body, and shall know and sense matters beyond the body, and perhaps even beyond the physical realm in which our body exists. 24 December 1967. At our departmental Christmas party, I related to Dr. Rand my best wishes for his new year, eager to hear how well his research is going, which has strange synergy to my own. As he intimates findings of multiple simultaneous consciousness in his surgeries, a sort of separation of mind and body thereby, independence of such consciousness. Of course, he does not see this precisely as I do, and he eschews the term mind, reminding me that when he teaches Psychology 101 to the gullibles, I always like the term for them, it's affectionately meant. The sweet young things like tiny minnows in my aquarium looking at me eagerly with their tiny palpitating mouths. How he solemnly feeds them his hooked line, "There is no soul." Poor darlings. And thereupon he always relates to the gullibles, intending to crush all dear religious sentimentalities, the edifying story of Jeremy Bentham, one of his favorite stories, which he delights to repeat to me even now over rum eggnog and Christmas cookies. How the great rationalist had himself publicly dissected after his death, organs identified and preserved, weighed, measured, etc., so that it could be proven he had not a soul. I do not doubt Mr. Bentham did not have a soul, I remarked to Dr. Rant. And I told him how Bentham's auto icon is now on display seated on a chair inside a glass case at University College London, consisting of his skeletal remains packed with padding and dressed in period costume. His head is a wax likeness. His own pickled head was once displayed between his shod feet, but was removed sometime in the past because Queen Victoria found it revolting. Dr. Rand said he would very much like to see this one day. He kindly asked me after my own research, but was clearly disinterested as I explained it. So I stopped, but could not resist irritating him with the propositions that I was investigating. He is such an officious man. He wondered if the department would approve my inquiry. I cannot but wonder what sort of mother he had. He is so sadly humorless. 20 January, 1968. Yesterday, at a White House conference on crime to which she had been invited, torch singer Eartha Kitt denounced the Vietnam War to Lady Bird Johnson while attending a ladies' lunch. She's reported to have said after Mrs. Johnson had engaged her and had invited her opinion, "You send the best of this country off to be shot and maimed. No wonder the kids rebel and take pot." The remark reportedly caused Mrs. Johnson to burst into tears. Sad that she, rather than the president, should receive the blame. Better that the president should burst into tears for the suffering wreaked upon so many innocent Vietnamese, for the destruction of our youth. He should weep. The whole nation should weep. I have distributed the questionnaire through our student affairs office. I should have liked a broader sample, but this one has a certain homogeneity that provides for elimination of some sampling errors. Almost all of our students are Caucasian, Christian, mostly middle class, mostly Midwestern, European origins, and these mostly Anglo-Saxon. I have called out the international students for this study. We shall see what we shall see. It is unlikely that if any report exomatic experiences, that these are NDE related, but of course I've already learned that even the very young have had such experiences, in some instances from serious illnesses, fevers and the like, or from serious accidents, almost drowning, for example, as one girl casually related to me. So I do not know with what frequency I shall receive responses. If this sampling is insufficient, I shall try another methodology. But I do not need a large sample for the most important activities of my research. I should like, however, to obtain some meaningful benchmarks in the first place. 1 February, 1968. I have received 143 responses. I'm astonished. I should not have guessed so many would have had exomatic experiences. The phenomenon is much more widespread than I had anticipated. I shall begin to collate these and shall assign some grad student to create punch cards for them tomorrow. The essays that many wrote are quite detailed. Evidently, the personal explication, the confession, if you will, of these profound experiences is something of very important significance to these young people, as though they have had the matter pent up for some time. I do suppose there are not many to whom they may confide these experiences. Having seen from Dr. Rand Winslow et al. Such a skepticism, not to say prejudice, which in some of their expressions is not merely intolerant, but hostile and demeaning. While the data shall be anonymous, I have a key by which I may contact the students through a blind communication in order to follow up upon what they have written. In this way, I hope to identify a few subjects and to persuade them to participate in laboratory experiments that I intend to undertake. On the CBS Nightly News tonight, Mr. Cronkite showed a brief video segment of a suspected Viet Cong publicly executed by a South Vietnamese national police chief. He shot him with a pistol to the side of his skull at close range. Shot him in the open street without regard to the television camera recording it face on. The suspect's hands were bound behind him. They showed the shocking footage twice in a row because it was so incredible to see, I suppose. But seeing it with a freeze frame, presented as the fatal bullet entered his skull, the man's grimace was truly horrible. Well, at that very moment, his executioner appeared placid, without any visible emotion. War's cruelty is thus exacted without emotion. We suppose there must be a sadomasochistic pleasure taken, but it's worse than that. It is remorseless and unfeeling. I think I cannot abide watching this war on television any longer. I shall read newspapers. I cannot watch these pornographic images. 24 February, 1968. The Guardian reports that the Tet Offensive is halted. South Vietnam recaptured Hue, but this is decidedly a propaganda loss for America. Our generals and our president have been telling us that there is light at the end of the tunnel and that victory is inevitable, but this seems to be an invincible, intractable enemy we oppose. Because they have shown the capacity to strike anywhere at will, they even attacked the American embassy in broad daylight. It's clear they have widespread popular support and an effective clandestine penetration of the South. Clearly the enemy is not the northern population alone. It is the majority of all Vietnamese. How can we prevail against such a popular cause? And is it just for us to prevail against the will of the people, for whom we say we are fighting the communists? Especially when the regime that we support against their will is so brutal, cowardly, and corrupt. This is not the same as the war my parents and I endured against Nazi Germany. And I fear it is now we, not our enemy, who may be guilty of genocide this time. The young people on our campus are agitated by this war, by the injustice of racism, poverty, intolerance, by the arrogant and violent response of the authorities to their righteous cause. This is, after all, a generation that believes deeply in the sacred values of America, was raised on superheated propaganda. The excess militant idealism of the war against totalitarianism, the continuation of that now during the Cold War, embraced, however, pimped, in fact, by a pernicious, self-interested agenda of certain authoritarian, ideological, and moneyed classes, thus carrying upon this pure idealism like crawling, blood-sucking body lice, the pestilence of rabid anti-communism, detestation of labor unions, fear of Negroes, the brute dominance of the oligarchy of wealth and privilege to which Americans think they are natively immune because of their revolution, but which is as imperious and obnoxious as the gentry of my own Britain. But as I say, my sweet gullibles believe the propaganda. What the movies say. Frank Capra's genuine everyman, John Doe, Mr. Smith, is at the heart of their political selves. They believe America ought to be a land of equality, of plenty for all. Hence, the vivid revelation of segregation, of malicious racism, that relentless legacy of slavery, shocks them. They come to the university and they learn by reading with an opened mind. Slavery was codified by us, writ by our founding fathers, plainly and intentionally preserved and promoted by the very constitution of this republic. The black man is counted as livestock, not a human being. Though my sweet gullibles were taught to believe that this same holy document extolled liberty and justice for all, this lie, this hypocrisy, this turning over the rocks that lie on America's main street to discover there the misery, degradation, and putrefaction of bodies in material poverty, and ironically, a putrefaction of souls among the affluent, it dismays them. Some, like Howard, whom I witlessly enjoined to that hell, have seen as I have seen the horrors of our insane asylums, warehouses of suffering souls, which should be hospitals of compassion, where medical tortures are performed upon them daily in the name of science. We all, but they especially, naive and wide-eyed, my sweet gullibles, are terribly awakened to the evil which our society tolerates, which we deny, we condone, and in which we ourselves participate to perpetuate by benumbed indifference to its existence. Of course, they are in a state of radical alienation to their own parents, their own society. Of course they want change, desperately. But how? They feel powerless. Many of the fine young men I know who may be drafted are openly discussing defiance of induction, even though it may result in their arrest or exile. My young apprentice, I should say graduate assistant, has lost his deferment and fears he will be inducted soon. Howard says he will resist, but this will ruin him, his brilliant, hopeful future. Of course, I sympathize. He does not want to kill. He does not want to be killed. If it occurs, I promised him that I have friends in Canada. He can obtain citizenship there and start a new life. Poor boy is not content with this. He wants the war to be ended. Howard had been a freedom rider in South Carolina last summer. So I should expect this political passion. And he is Jewish. His grandmother is a Holocaust survivor. He believes in a destiny of unjust tragedy. How do we find ourselves the actors of dramas written by history by social forces larger than ourselves? What covenant of God is this? 3 weeks ago in Orangeburg, several young Negroes were attempting to enter a local bowling alley and were denied service and began a spontaneous protest. A rubbish can was lit on fire. Police came, outnumbering the small number of youths. The police later insisted they had been attacked by small weapons fire. Protesters insisted they had no weapons, but did hurl various objects and insults at the police. The officers fired into the crowd, killing 3 young Negro men and wounding 27 others, mostly bystanders. At a press conference the following day, Governor McNair said the event was the result of outside agitators, the Black Power. Howard knew one of the young men killed. Having shared housing with him during his activities there last summer, he said he feels that he should have been there beside him. He wept in my arms. He feels. All these children here feel responsible for the evils of our society, it seems. How shall we be redeemed? How shall they be comforted? Must they die? Howard then said he thinks perhaps he should volunteer for Vietnam. I told him to go home and see his grandmother and ask her what he should do.
Well, come on, all of you big, strong men. Uncle Sam needs your help again. Got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Vietnam. Put down your books and pick up a gun. We're gonna have a whole lot of fun. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, wonder why we're all gonna die. Now come on, Wall Street, don't be slow. Why, man, this is war, a go-go. There's plenty good money to be made supplying the army wheels of the trade. Just open David if they drop the bomb. We're dropping on the Viet Cong. And it's one, two, three. What are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. The next stop is Vietnam. And it's five, six, seven. Open up the pearly gates. Well, ain't no time to wonder why we're all gonna die.